Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, we're going to devote the entire hour to a towering figure in science, and that is the life of Albert Einstein. In the first half hour, we're going to bring on John Brinster of Princeton, talking about Einstein's religious and spiritual point of view. And in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on Fred Jerome, author of the book The Einstein Files, talking about Einstein's politics. Now, also, I'm coming out with a new book in just 2 weeks, and I'll be on a national book tour. So maybe I'll be signing your copy of my latest book, The Future of the Mind. And in fact, did you know that Einstein's brain was actually preserved by the pathologist who did the autopsy on Albert Einstein? And by analyzing Einstein's brain, new insights have been achieved on the question of what is genius. In fact, I have a whole chapter in my new book, The Future of the Mind, concerning intelligence. So let me tell you that the book is about all the incredible developments in neurology just in the last 10, 15 years. Did you know that telepathy, telekinesis, uploading memories, even recording thoughts and photographing a dream, and being able to record some of the thinkings of the living brain have been achieved? We've been able to put a chip in people's brains who are totally paralyzed. These people are vegetables, and we've allowed them to be able to lead a semi-normal life. These people can now read email, write email, surf the web, play video games, do crossword puzzles, operate a wheelchair, operate household appliances, and they are totally paralyzed. In fact, research is now being done to hook up the human brain to an exoskeleton, giving people who are brain injured a new chance at life. Think of Christopher Reeve, the handsome actor who plays Superman in those movies. He suffered from a horrendous injury to his spinal cord, and he died paralyzed from the neck down. These people can now have the gift of movement. It's now possible to hook them up to a mechanical arm, a leg, and an exoskeleton so they can begin to have a semi-normal life. For more information about my book tour, go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org, or also my Facebook site. In fact, we have about 1 million fans on that Facebook site. I should also point out that I'll be in Milwaukee on February 26th, Chicago on February 27th. I'll be in the San Francisco, Berkeley Bay Area, February 28th in Berkeley, then March 1st, March 2nd in San Francisco. March 3rd, I'll be in Denver. March 4th, I'll be in Seattle. March 5th, I'll be speaking in Boston. March 6th, I'll be speaking in New York City. And then March 17th, I'll be in Kentucky, Kansas City on March 18th, Ohio on March 19th and 20th, and Los Angeles on March 21st and March 22nd. Once again, the book is called The Future of the Mind. We're talking about the most explosive developments in neuroscience that have been accomplished just within the last 10 to 15 years. And like I said before, the brain of Albert Einstein has been preserved, believe it or not, and it's led to new insights on the question of genius. And that's why we have devoted this whole hour to the question of Einstein, not just his theories, but of course his religion, his spirituality, and of course his politics. So once again, today on Exploration, we're going to talk not just about Einstein's theories, but about Einstein's religion, as well as his political views. So our first special guest today is Mr. John Brinster of Princeton. He's a graduate of Princeton University. He's had extensive experience in physics, telemetry, was an associate of Wernher von Braun, as well as Albert Einstein, and he's written extensively about Albert Einstein's spiritual and religious beliefs. The first question for you is, how did you first get to know Albert Einstein?
Well, because I was a student at Princeton. I graduated in physics in 1943, and he was in the community. And I moved within a block or two from where he lived at 112 Mercer Road, and my family saw him quite frequently walking to the Institute for Advanced Study. My prime contacts were in symposia and meetings, not so much on a personal level. I listened intently to everything he said when he spoke, but my interest in Einstein was in his mind and his ideas of spirituality as opposed to physics.
Okay. Well, sometimes Einstein, when asked whether or not he had a philosophy of the universe and God, would mention that he believed in the God of Spinoza. Well, what is that? Could you explain a little bit about some of his religious and philosophical beliefs that seem to coincide with those of Spinoza?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm completely qualified to discuss Spinoza, although Einstein did mention him on many occasions. What Einstein answered to the many questions that he was asked about spirituality was basically specific. He was very convinced of his position. Churchmen would ask him questions, write letters to him, and he would answer those letters on the back of the envelopes in which the questions came, and they were always directed to one thing, and that he did not believe in any personal God. He did not believe that prayer was effective, that there could be any response from prayer to a personal God, but he believed in a transcendental natural force, which he felt he could never fully understand. He admired nature. He admired the beauty of nature, and he always used the word imperfectly with respect to the understanding of nature. So, in effect, I interpreted his religion to be what I had written at times about a natural religion, one in which the forces of nature were the forces of the universe, and man being very new in the universe, only a million years or so old, would never understand nature entirely.
Okay. Well, let's talk about a little bit about Isaac Newton and other physicists. Many physicists look at material forces, objective, material, mechanical forces that govern our world, as set forth first by Isaac Newton. But Newton himself believed in God, not necessarily such a personal God that answers prayers, but a God that set things into motion. Now, Einstein, being a great physicist, whose laws actually replaced those of Isaac Newton, well, where in those laws do we see the hand of God?
In my opinion, being very interested in the human mind and how it works, of course, we knew very little about neuroscience at the time of Einstein, but in time we learned more and more about it. And in the development of the human brain, in the process of emergence from the animal brain, it's clear that the brain developed an area, the prefrontal area, of judgment, reason, and logic, which didn't exist prior to that time. And yet, the animal emotions, which humans inherited, were very powerful. And my view is, and maybe I interpreted this a little bit from the Einstein view, is that the period of development of human logic is not yet ended. That is, we may only be halfway into the period. That is logic, judgment, and reason are still developing in man, and perhaps in a few more millennia, we will see religion quite differently.
Okay, well, let's talk about science and religion. Einstein once said that science without religion is lame, but religion without science is blind. So he loved to talk about God. He called God the Old One, the Lawgiver, but in some sense it was a God of harmony, the God of unity, rather than the personal God that answers prayers and parts the waters and intervenes in the affairs of men and women. So could you explain to us a little bit about what is this God of harmony, the Lawgiver, as Einstein used to write?
Well, obviously he did mention God many times. He certainly mentioned God informally in his conversations with his fellow scientists. And some of the theological people probably misinterpret that to relate to a personal God. But I understand it, as you do, that his reference to God was the God of nature, the God that followed all the laws of nature that man is attempting to learn and survive by, so that his God was essentially the God that I tried to define in this new book.
Now, Einstein once wrote a beautiful passage concerning how he viewed knowledge, science, and the entire universe in the following way. He said that if you are a child entering a library full of millions and millions of volumes, you are in awe of this vast storehouse of knowledge, and yet you can only pick up the first volume. And you can only read perhaps a few pages of the first volume. And yet in front of you is this huge library of knowledge. And in some sense, he said, the library is the universe. The library is a storehouse of wondrous facts, wondrous information, wondrous equations. And we are the child, humanity, all of science is nothing but a child entering this library, able to only read the first volume and perhaps only a few pages of the first volume. So what are your thoughts concerning how Einstein viewed this great library of knowledge?
Well, I go back to what I said before. That is, from the very beginning, the human mind has developed a bank of knowledge. One bit of knowledge is added to another, and much of this has been written down according to the interpretation of the writer. All writing hasn't matched perfectly, but humanity in the many millennia of existence has, through the function of the mind, drawn conclusions about the position of man and about the nature of the universe, and that all has been recorded and eventually has been sifted out and drawn to specific conclusions. Your mind, for example, I understand, has concentrated a lot on the complexity of the universe, of the multiplicity of the 10 dimensions of string theory, and that sort of thing. I'm way behind you. I'm still with Bohr and Heisenberg and Wigner, Feynman, Pauli, John Wheeler, you're a modern scientist, and you are apt to see things quite differently with basically the same mind that Einstein applied to his theoretical work.
Okay, well, would it be fair to say that in some sense there are two kinds of God, that we have to be more careful about the word God, that Einstein did not believe in the God of intervention, the God that answers prayers, the God that parts the waters, the God that smites the Philistines, not that kind of God, but the God of harmony, the God of unification. And that God then set the universe into motion. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, that would be a fair statement, but you have to bear in mind that all those words that you bring forth are human words developed from the human mind. As the mind's interpretation of what it acquires through its five senses. I often think that the interpretation of nature is quite impossible because there is no language in the human mind that's a very recent age that can apply to the to nature, which has existed essentially forever. We haven't developed the language to describe the God of nature, so to speak.
Okay, now let's talk about where the universe came from in Genesis. Genesis said God set the whole thing into motion. Now physicists have the Big Bang Theory, and the Big Bang Theory simply set itself into motion for reasons we don't understand. But then people ask the embarrassing question, well, where did the Big Bang come from? Well, maybe perhaps there were many bangs. But then the other question is, even if you have many sequences of Big Bangs in a multiverse of universes, then where did the physics come from? Where did Einstein's equations come from? In other words, you go all the way back, even further than the Big Bang, to the laws of physics themselves. And at that point, Einstein would simply say, well, those are given to us by God. Now, this is not intelligent design. This is not the intelligent design of certain people who dispute evolution and say that there's a hand of God creating evolution in one way, creating humans as a watchmaker designs watches. However, we are left with this embarrassing question. If there is a unified field theory, the theory that Einstein tried to find that would allow him to, quote, read the mind of God, then where did the unified field theory come from?
Well, you're very right to question that, and it's certainly a difficult question. I believe it goes back to the idea that I mentioned before, and that is the human mind has many limitations. It goes back to the very structure and function of the mind itself. The brain is a biological mechanism. It's stimulated by five senses. The information that it acquires goes through the hippocampus to what we call memory, and that memory is used as the basis for all behavior and action. And I'm not so sure that the human brain is in a position yet to have sufficient understanding to explain any of that which you say. The human mind, again, is so limited still, being no more than a million years old. Perhaps in another million years or so, it may have developed further. There may be more neurons, more complexity, more understanding. My book, The Man Who Created God, was based on not only Einstein's idea of religion, but how a formal religion would be created if Einstein were an aggressive religious leader.
Okay. Now, also, when Einstein was asked, what is your goal in life? He said that his goal in life was to, quote, read the mind of God. That is, have an equation, perhaps no more than 1 inch long, that would allow him to unify all the laws of physics. That was his goal in life. So, in some sense, if you were to ask, then, what is the God of Einstein? The God of Einstein, in some sense, would be the unified field theory. That is, this one-inch equation from which everything springs, the Big Bang, the formation of galaxies, the creation of the planet Earth, all of these would be summarized into one equation. And from what I read of Einstein's work, God is either the unified field theory itself or the creator of the unified field theory. You think that's a fair statement?
I don't think it's entirely a fair statement. I think the idea is a good one. I don't think that Einstein really felt that there was an entity, a God entity, that would allow humans to define the universe and its function with a small mathematical formula. I felt that beyond that he was assumed it was more complicated than that. You remember that in his later years, he said more about people of the existing world. He had great empathy for people of the world, and he moved somewhat away from theoretical physics to his concern about people of the world. And in a sense, the book that I wrote says that we will never really understand some of the things that you question. And it might be a good idea for the existing cultures of the world to begin to decide on a unity of belief around nature rather than a personal God, and get to the point where beliefs are more unified, and the matter of imaginative structure that the mind engages in is a deterrent to the natural development, neural development of logic. And if I think he agreed that if we could eliminate the imaginative side of religion, the human mind would progress to much greater judgmental capability. People would agree. There would be much more universal, peaceful coexistence. That was constantly on his later mind.
Okay, and speaking about that, when Einstein was a child, when he was very young, one year he became extremely religious. He would cite religious texts. He would actually write hymnals to God, poems to God, and he would sing religious songs on his way to school and back. But then what happened was he read a science book. And the more he read about science, the more he realized that there was this vast discrepancy between what he learned reading these religious books and the books of science, which were reproducible, provable, falsifiable, not just matters of faith, but matters of simply observation and experiment. So he saw this fundamental conflict there. So do you think, therefore, that is this fundamental conflict that every scientist feels, that when we try to bridge the world of science and religion, that at some point a scientist realizes that natural laws can explain the universe much better than miracles?
You're absolutely right, and I should tell you that I had a similar experience in my life. I was born and brought up as a Catholic. I served Mass at a theological seminary every morning at 5:30 in the morning until I reached a similar age, about the same age as Einstein did when he began to think differently. The rites and ceremonies did not match modern understanding as knowledge developed. And I understand his experience in that regard because of my own experience.
Okay, now, if you were to then look at the current debate, a lot of people are debating about God today, God, the Bible, intelligent design. How do you think Einstein would view it if he were alive today? Would he be horrified that that fundamentalist Christians are trying to inject ideology on biology classes? And, of course, these fundamentalists also want to ban the Big Bang Theory. And the Big Bang Theory is nothing but a natural consequence of Einstein's theory and has been essentially verified looking at astronomical data. So what do you think Einstein's reaction would be looking at the current debate?
Einstein would be absolutely horrified at some of the discussions that are taking place today.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, our special guest for the first half of the program has been John Brinster of Princeton, who's written extensively about the religious and philosophical and spiritual side of Albert Einstein. And our second guest coming on in a few minutes is Fred Jerome, author of the book The Einstein Files, talking about Einstein's voluminous political activities and his equally voluminous FBI file. Well, if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. And also dial into my website. It's www.mkaku.org. mkaku.org. And so far we've logged over 40 million hits on that website. So stay tuned now for the second half of Exploration as we leave Einstein's spiritual side and go to Einstein's political side, because this is the year of Einstein. In fact, it was 100 years ago this month that Albert Einstein wrote down E equals mc squared and changed our universe. Welcome back to Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And in this hour, we're talking about Einstein's religious, political, spiritual point of view. And also, as I mentioned, I even mention Einstein's brain in my new book, The Future of the Mind.
And once again, go to my website and you can see a complete list of cities where I'll be speaking. Maybe I'll be signing your copy of The Future of the Mind. All the explosive developments done in neuroscience just within the last 10 to 15 years. Did you know that we've learned more about the brain in that period of time than in all of recorded history put together? Things like telepathy, mind reading, telekinesis, uploading memories, recording memories, even photographing a dream. They were once considered to be impossible, and now we can do it in the laboratory. Find out how by getting a copy of The Future of the Mind. And once again, the book also talks about people who are mentally ill. What is mental illness anyway? And also, President Barack Obama has allocated, and the European Union, have allocated $1 billion to explore all the neural pathways of the brain. This could be like a new human genome project on that scale. So the brain could be the center of enormous scientific investigation into the next decade. And once again, I should point out that my book tour starts on February 26th in Milwaukee. In February 27th, I'll be in Chicago. February 28th, I'll be speaking in Berkeley. March 1st and 2nd San Francisco. March 3rd in Denver. March 4th in Seattle. March 5th in Boston. March 6th in New York City. And then Kentucky in March 17, Kansas March 18, Ohio March 19 and 20, Los Angeles March 21st and 22nd, then Rhode Island on March 25, Stony Brook, Long Island March 26, and Jacksonville, Florida on March 27th. See you then. But once again, in this section of exploration, we're talking to two guests who are talking about the politics and the religion of Albert Einstein. In this section, we'll be talking to Fred Jerome, author of the book, The Einstein Files. Mr. Jerome, how did you first get interested in tracking down, of all things, Albert Einstein's FBI file?
Well, actually, it was about 8 years ago. I was doing a magazine piece on the media's coverage of Einstein, and I stumbled across a small reference in the New York Times, and I mean like page 17 of section D, right next to the weather map, which referred to the fact that the FBI had a file on him. And I was quite surprised and decided to go and get it. And when I read that file, especially after I obtained virtually the entire 1,800-page file on him, it was then that I realized that there was a tremendous amount of information there that had been denied to us. It was almost like a shipment of history that had been hijacked. And I decided to write the book, which came out 2 years ago, The Einstein File, J. Edgar Hoover's Secret War Against the World's Most Famous Scientist.
Okay, well, let's talk about Einstein's political evolution, because his evolution, of course, spanned many decades.
Yes.
And he was there at very, very important pivotal events in world history and participated in some of them. So let's get back to his childhood. What was it going all the way back to his early days in Germany that led to his rather accelerated political evolution?
Well, he was born in 1879. And it was, he came of age, you might say, with both electricity and imperialism. Maybe that would account for some of his scientific pursuits, that is, the electricity, and the imperialism maybe with his, account for some of his political directions. The Kaiser, the German Kaiser, said, I think around the same year he was born, maybe a year earlier, the great questions of the day will not be settled by resolutions and majority votes, but by blood and iron. And so you had the building up of this very militaristic Prussian society and a very militaristic Prussian army, which he, and also there was at the time a lot of anti-Semitism in Germany. In any case, he decided to avoid that militaristic Prussian army by leaving the country.
Now, a lot of teenagers don't all of a sudden decide to leave the country, renounce your citizenship. This is a rather dramatic statement to make. So was it that he was rebelling against Prussian militarism and conformity? Is that the reason why he decided to leave his country and give up German citizenship?
I think primarily. I mean, he was in school. He talked about his reaction to school was that elementary school teachers were like sergeants and high school teachers were like lieutenants. And, I mean, he'd been rebelling against it for some time. It wasn't a sudden, he didn't wake up one day and decided he was going to rebel.
Mm-hmm.
But his family, his parents actually were moving their business, which there was also a depression at the time, and small businesses were having a difficult time, and so on. But he was able to move to Switzerland about as easily as I think a lot of people during Vietnam were able to move to Canada. And fortunately, he was able to go to school there. And when he went to the university in Zurich, around the turn of the century, just before the turn of the century, it turns out that there were a lot of political refugees from other countries in Europe also hanging around Zurich. And so he probably learned a good deal of his politics in Zurich at the Odeon Cafe, which was a popular gathering place for radical Russian refugees and others like Trotsky and Kolontai and so on and so forth. Not that he didn't go to class, but sometimes he didn't go to class.
Okay, so here we have a draft dodger, someone who renounces his own German nationality, tries to apply for Swiss citizenship, and then is right in the thick of some of the greatest scientific turmoils of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, there were war clouds also looming around that time. So, of course, he was very well aware that as he became more prominent in the world of physics, that world war could break out.
Mm-hmm.
So given the fact that at Berlin University, where he finally aspired to when relativity theory finally bust open on the scene,
mm-hmm.
Many of the faculty members at the University of Berlin signed a manifesto agreeing with the Kaiser that
right.
this was a way to
right.
Support German civilization.
Most of them did, yes.
And so what did Einstein do, given the fact that there was all this war hysteria surrounding his university?
Well, it's interesting. I think, you know, when he went back to Berlin from Switzerland in early 1914, he probably didn't expect World War II to break out. It was a little bit. I like to compare it to canceling a camping trip for a seat on the on a ship that's about to be sunk.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, he did. War did break out a few years after he got back to Berlin. A few months after he got back to Berlin, in 1914, and he was one of really three academics in Germany who refused to sign this manifesto supporting the Kaiser's attack on the uncivilized hordes. Some of the words are much more explicit than that, and called for an end to the war and a united Europe.
So he was really sticking his neck out at that point, right? You figure he was a Jewish physicist in a country that was swept up by war fever. All the faculty were going with the Kaiser
mm-hmm.
in terms of enlisting for the military and working for the military. And here were these three intellectuals that opposed this gigantic tidal wave.
Yeah, I think he probably had a little bit of immunity from attack. Certainly, one of the other intellectuals was. Almost arrested and was exiled from Germany. I think because he was Einstein and had already had his miracle year, and then in 1916 came up with the general theory of relativity, or was it 1917? To some extent, they would allow him a little bit more leeway in what he said, but you never know how much, you know. And I think he was sticking his neck out to some extent.
Okay, and let's talk a little bit about his political activities between wars.
Okay.
One thing I found out that I didn't know about was that the University of Berlin, after the chaos of World War I, was taken over by radical students.
Yeah.
And they had barricaded the campus and had actually taken the president of Berlin University hostage.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was this crisis between the Weimar Republic and the German students.
Yeah.
And the German students wanted a radical professor who could negotiate a deal.
Yeah.
And, of course, everyone said, well, obviously it's got to be Einstein.
Right. Einstein actually, there are a number of versions of what exactly happened during that particular period of uprising. But it seems clear that Einstein basically supported the Weimar Republic at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And how much he was able to influence the radical students, I'm not sure. But it is on record that he told them that they ought to support the Weimar Republic and give it a chance, and so on and so forth, which eventually did happen. I don't think he was able to totally detour the revolt. I don't think his words alone were able to detour the revolt.
Right. Well, Max Born, who is one of the founders of the quantum theory,
mm-hmm.
Actually accompanied Einstein on his visit to the students.
Right.
He went past the barricades,
right,
where there were, you know, trash bins on fire and chaos, mm-hmm, in the streets. And here we have two Nobel laureate physicists,
right,
on their way to meet the radical students. And
yeah,
then after that, they went to the Reichstag,
mm-hmm,
and they met with the Weimar Republic leaders,
mm-hmm,
and they began to broker a deal.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it led to the release of the president of the poor university,
mm-hmm,
who was captured by the students.
Yeah.
Now, also, one of the leaders of the Austrian Social Democratic Party, his son,
right,
assassinated,
right,
one of the leaders of the German government, and the assassin was actually a physicist.
Right.
A physicist who was actually a friend of Einstein.
They had become friends in Zurich, actually.
Right.
They had been schoolmates.
Right. A professor,
yeah,
Adler.
Right.
And normally, you would figure that a physicist who was a friend of an assassin would run for cover,
mm-hmm,
and basically try to protect their own skin by saying, I don't know this person.
Right.
Who is this person who just assassinated a German official?
Yes.
But here's Einstein coming to his defense.
Yeah, he actually testified on his behalf and offered to and really maybe saved his life.
That's right. So
yeah,
we have this stereotype of Einstein being this kind of absent-minded professor. But if anything, he was razor sharp. He knew exactly what he was doing. He knew the limits of how far he could push, how far his fame could protect him.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because that really is the key to my book and anybody who looks into Einstein's politics, is that we have been handed down this image in the last, certainly since Einstein's death, of a sort of bumbling, absent-minded, kindly old professor with his head too high in the clouds, thinking of abstract equations, to be concerned about what's going on in the real world. Whereas the fact of the matter is, he was quite concerned, and he continued to be concerned. And he was concerned when he was in this country, and he opposed McCarthyism. He was very outspoken, and he particularly opposed racism in this country. And it's not at all the image that we have been handed down over the last 50 years.
When I was growing up, some people would say, when they mentioned his politics at all, they would say that he was naive, that he didn't really understand the larger real forces at work.
Mm-hmm.
But if anything, to me, it's the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't see himself as a pragmatic compromise maker that cuts deals in,
mm-hmm,
a parliament. That was not his role.
No.
His role was to be more like a Gandhi, to set the spiritual and moral tenor of the affair. That was his role. And I think he was very clearly cognizant of the role that he would play in political crises.
Yeah. In fact, we're skipping past a few things here, but just to mention it, he was asked to endorse and support hundreds and hundreds of organizations. And he actually did endorse and support, I counted, some 70 of those. But each one was carefully thought through, and many were rejected. And it was those which he supported, which he felt were going to be the most effective. He lent his prestige, really, to the cause of his moral and political indignation.
Right.
As been said.
Right. Now let's move on a little bit. War clouds start to brew once again as World War II approaches.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1933, Einstein leaves the country for good. And the newspapers say that the Pope of Physics has left. The new Vatican is Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
However, the question is, what was Einstein's attitude toward the Nazis? Some pacifists said that we should allow Hitler to take power and show what an idiot he is,
mm-hmm,
allow him to do his dirty work. Well, Einstein said no.
Yeah, almost as soon as the Nazis came to power, and maybe even before then a little bit, his position, his pacifism, which he had, after World War One, he had become involved in pacifist organizations such as the War Resisters League and others around the world. His pacifism began to be, he began to qualify his pacifism because of the Nazis. And he felt that the Nazis presented such a horrendous threat to mankind that they probably could only be defeated through a military struggle. And we know now that he wrote the letter to Roosevelt in 1939, urging Roosevelt to consider launching an atomic bomb project, because he was convinced at that time that the Nazis had launched an atomic bomb project. And he didn't want Hitler and the Nazis to have a sort of an atomic monopoly and be able to blackmail the rest of the world with the atomic bomb.
And as history has shown, Einstein's instincts, once again, were much much more clear than the so-called political realists. As we now know, Germany did have a very active atomic bomb project set up before the United States. We know that the world's greatest quantum physicist, Werner Heisenberg, was the head of the German Nazi program. And we now know, just within the last few years, that Werner Heisenberg did not sabotage the German project, but he actively worked on a German atomic bomb.
Right.
So we have the world's greatest quantum physicist working for the Nazis to build a super bomb for Germany.
Absolutely. And I think Einstein, even after the war, because after the Germans, after it became clear the Germans, despite Heisenberg, were not going to succeed in making an atomic bomb, Einstein's position changed, and he did not want the U.S. to use the atomic bomb.
Now, by the way, during the war, a lot of people, of course, asked the simple question, why doesn't Einstein work on top-secret military projects? But apparently the military itself at that point axed the idea that Einstein would work on the atomic bomb.
One of the points I make in my book, The Einstein File, is that J. Edgar Hoover was instrumental in helping the military, military intelligence, actually deny security clearance to Einstein in 1940, the same year he became a citizen. And it was based on that denial that Einstein was unable to work on the Manhattan Project.
But isn't it also true that J. Edgar Hoover was intimidated by Einstein? I mean, everyone around Einstein was grilled by the FBI except Einstein himself. He was never grilled by the FBI. And so some people speculate that maybe J. Edgar Hoover was actually intimidated by Einstein.
Well, it's possible. I like to think of it as not just intimidated by Einstein, but by the fact that Einstein had such a worldwide following that I think Hoover knew. And, in fact, in the file, he makes several references to the fact, ordering his men not to interrogate Einstein, not to interrogate anyone who might tell Einstein that he was being asked about, because Einstein had this habit of calling press conferences and telling the world about these things. And so I think that what he was afraid of in the case of Einstein was that Einstein would tell everybody that the FBI was investigating him, and Hoover would look like the ass that he was, and, you know, a laughingstock of the world. So I don't think it was just Einstein alone that intimidated Hoover, but Einstein and his worldwide following, which was so tremendous.
Okay, now let's take a look at the post-war era. Einstein was asked after Hiroshima, would he have worked on the atomic bomb, and knowing what he did about what happened to Hiroshima, and he said that if he had known that his work would lead to the bombing of Hiroshima, he would have become a fisherman rather than a theoretical physicist.
Yes.
So now what happens after the bombing of Hiroshima?
Well, I think even I just mentioned it, even before the bombing of Hiroshima, Einstein wrote a letter to Roosevelt again at the behest of Leo Szilard, urging Roosevelt not to bomb Japan. And it was found on Roosevelt's desk the morning after Roosevelt died. And so that there was this strong feeling among many scientists, Einstein included, against the bombing of Hiroshima. After that bombing, many of the scientists who worked on the bomb, including Szilard and Oppenheimer, well, many of them, data and so on, formed a committee, or many committees, actually. The committee that Einstein became the chairman of was the Emergency Committee of Atomic Scientists. And they issued protest after protest against the growing nuclear arms race. And they also spread information about the nature of nuclear weapons among the public, to the public, which this got the FBI terribly upset, because the FBI was convinced they were going to release information about the atomic bomb, and the Russians were going to read it, and then the Russians would have the atomic bomb.
Now, I understand that in different versions, incarnations of these groups still exist. The Emergency Committee of Atomic Scientists no longer exists, but we have the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists.
Yes.
And that network of nuclear physicists set up by Einstein still exists as the Federation of American Scientists.
That's
many
correct.
Of them populated by nuclear physicists who worked on the atomic bomb during the Manhattan Project years.
That's correct. And Einstein articles were, I think, in the very first issue of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. He had a piece and several others. And that still exists. And the spirit, I think, still exists, the spirit of reaching out to the public on these questions has not been completely crushed.
Okay. Now let's talk about the McCarthy years.
Yes.
And once again, when the waters get troubled, there's a tendency for professors to run like hell and hide under the covers.
Mm-hmm.
And here's Einstein going right up against McCarthyism.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about that.
I think it may be that perhaps his greatest legacy to the future, or as great as any, I don't want to take away from any of his science, the legacy of his science, but I'm not the first one to say this. An Einstein expert in Boston, John Stachel, who's the head of the Center for Einstein Studies at Boston University, has said this, that one of his greatest legacies certainly is his example of the courage that he demonstrated in standing up to the McCarthy committees and the other congressional investigating committees and urging people to refuse to answer questions. This is in 1953, even if it meant going to jail, and that it was the only way to defeat these committees. And if enough people did it, the committees would be finished and McCarthyism would be finished. And it was a call for civil disobedience at a time when he was the first one to do that, really, and was attacked for doing that, even by the New York Times and the Washington Post. And yet he did it, and it did have an impact on many people. Within a year, McCarthy was on the rocks, and I think he was censured the next year, 1954. In any case, Einstein's call, urging of witnesses to refuse to answer questions from these committees, it made the front page of the New York Times twice in 1 year, in 1953, in June and in December. And if it made the front page of the New York Times, you can be sure it made the front page of newspapers around the world then as now. And had a tremendous impact, I think, on the sort of turning around of the McCarthy period, although that turning around took a while to complete.
Right. Now let's talk about racism. Einstein, of course, being Jewish, had to bear the brunt of anti-Semitism, especially in Germany.
Yes.
But also, he was very involved with the African American movement here in this country, which is not widely known.
Absolutely.
Could you elaborate?
Of all the little known aspects of Einstein's political dimension, his anti-lynching and anti-racism activity is the least known. And in 1946, after World War II, there was a wave of lynchings that swept across America, especially the southern states. Some 56 black men and women, mostly GIs, were lynched in this country, compared to something like three in the last year before the war. And Einstein spoke out against that, as he had on many other issues. And in September of 1946, he was co-chairman with Paul Robeson of a group called the American Crusade to End Lynching, which led a march on Washington in September to demand that the federal government pass anti-lynching legislation. Einstein wrote a letter to Truman. He was unable to actually attend the march because of his poor health. He also spoke at Lincoln University, a black college the oldest black college in this hemisphere. He spoke there in 1946 in May and received an honorary degree. And he generally did not do this during the last years of his life. He didn't go to colleges. Okay, he had many invitations. But he wanted to send a message, and the message that he sent in the speech was that racism was the worst. Well, he said in this speech, he said segregation was a white man's disease, and I'm not going to remain silent about it. And later on, he said racism was America's worst disease. And this, what's interesting is that this speech at Lincoln University in 1946, the most famous scientist in the world at the oldest black institution of learning in the hemisphere, not a word has been published in a single biography of Einstein anywhere, and that counts hundreds of books. And it's an example of the fact that this vital aspect of Einstein's outlook has been kept from us. And I think in this day and age especially, we all suffer as a result of not knowing it.
Okay, now let's talk about the Jewish question, mm-hmm. because obviously he bore the brunt of a lot of anti-Jewish slurs and discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
But just before he died, being this world figure that he was actually offered the presidency of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, what was his position on Zionism and his relationship to Israel?
Actually, that offering him of the presidency by Israel was a very clever public relations move. It got a lot of attention. In fact, Einstein, when they offered it to him, I have a quote here from Ben-Gurion, which said that, what are we ever going to do if he accepts the presidency? Because I've had to offer it to him because it's impossible not to, but if he accepts, he says, we are in for trouble. And I think the fact of the matter is that Einstein was highly critical of the policy of the Israeli government and the Zionist leadership, of their policy, especially their policy towards Arabs. And at one point he wrote to Weizmann, the head of Zionism, he said, if we do not succeed in finding the path of honest cooperation and coming to terms with the Arabs, we will not have learned anything from our 2,000-year-old ordeal and will deserve the fate which will beset us. And another time he said, the most important aspect of Israel's policy must be our ever-present manifest desire to institute complete equality for the Arab citizens living in our midst. And the attitude we adopt towards the Arab minority will provide the real test of our moral standards as a people. And there's more. I mean, it's something that's not widely known, and I know that there are Jews some in this country who don't like to hear this. But the fact of the matter is, there's a lot of statements like this. Einstein actually opposed the formation of the Jewish state until after it was formed, and then he did support it.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guests have been John Brinster, an associate of Albert Einstein, speaking about his religious points of view, and also Fred Jerome, author of the book The Einstein Files. And if you want to learn more about Einstein's theory and his life, you might want to pick up a copy of my book called Einstein's Cosmos. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230, 735-0230. Also, dial into my website. It's www.mkaku.org, mkaku.org. And so far, we've logged over 40 million hits on that website. Good day.